Take it on faith. Next case on the court's calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Willie Alonzo Smith. We're ready for argument. So counsel for appellant, please approach the podium and introduce yourself for the record before you begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. May it please the court, my name is Jessica Mers-Goddess, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Willie Smith, who is present in the courtroom this morning. The issue before the court is whether the district court erred by not suppressing the marijuana as fruit of an unlawful de facto arrest. Now, I'd like to clarify something right from the get-go, and that's this issue of speeding. The district court credited the officer's testimony that he first observed Mr. Smith's vehicle speeding. So we would acknowledge that what that fact does is give the officer reasonable, articulable suspicion to seize Mr. Smith to investigate the speeding. But that is not what happened here. He didn't seize him to investigate the speeding. He seized him, and he immediately expanded the scope of the seizure to investigate what the officer deemed to be suspicious behavior. Now, an expansion is going to be lawful only if it is supported by independent probable cause or reasonable articulable suspicion of other criminal activity that's going to justify that additional intrusion. And there simply was not. And we know that by looking at the facts of this case. What the district court found and what the officer testified to at the omnibus hearing is that what he had observed was Mr. Smith make an abrupt turn into a residential driveway, which the officer deemed evasive. Mr. Smith walked up to a residence, to the residence door, but then returned to the Land Rover and got back in the Land Rover. And then he exited the passenger side and stood on the passenger side of the Land Rover, which the officer deemed an attempt to avoid him. Those facts fall far short of constituting specific and articulable facts that would create a reasonable articulable suspicion that Mr. Smith is engaged at that point in any criminal activity. Now, like Davis, which is discussed at length in my brief, I would suggest to the court that what the facts show here is a support for nothing more than mere suspicion, a mere hunch that Mr. Smith had or was about to engage in violation of some law, some unarticulated crime. Now, this seizure converted almost immediately into a de facto arrest. How do we know that? Let's look at what we have here. We have a criminal.
Counsel, before you get to the de facto arrest argument, in your recitation of the facts, it seemed to me you were missing a few points that I see raised both in the district court's decision as well as by the respondent. So, for instance, and maybe I just missed it. You might have said it, and I've just missed it. But if you'd factor into it also the sequence of events in terms of as you said, the officer certainly could follow based on the speeding, the observation of speeding, but the quick, turn into the driveway, not entering the home, it's the sequence of events, not entering the home, coming back out, going on the passenger side, seeing the feet only, and then followed up by when the officer does request, can I talk to you, the belligerence and the closed fist. So, because I think all of that happens before the point at which you say there's a de facto arrest, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
I think you're right, but I think what we need to separate first is, as you've articulated and as I articulated, the sequence of events. So what happens at the moment of the seizure, and of course the seizure is the beckoning him to come down away from your vehicle and come down to my squad car. They haven't had any interaction with each other yet, so the belligerence hasn't happened at the moment of the seizure. The alleged belligerence happens after. So that's a factor that we would consider here to determine whether there was probable cause to support a de facto arrest. I think we first have to take that step back before we're talking about whether there was or was not probable cause. Of course, the threshold question is going to be, are we in fact talking about a de facto arrest? Which our position is it was. The district court decided there was not.
When did it become a de facto arrest?
So at the moment after the seizure, when the officer beckoned Mr. Smith down to the car, what we have here is a criminal suspect, the officer suspected him of committing or about to be committing some kind of a crime, who is put in handcuffs, who is confined to the back of the squad car, and who is told that he is being detained. Okay. Now,
Your position regarding when the arrest occurred?
Correct. Because
so before any of that occurred, all of the things that Judge Bratfold has described had occurred?
Correct.
So the observations, sort of what's described as belligerent conduct, the clenched fist, all of that happens before handcuffs and put in squad.
Correct.
And told you're being detained.
Correct. And I do plan to talk about the alleged belligerence and the clenched fist, but I see that as facts that go to whether or not there was probable cause for an arrest or not. I wanted to put that aside for a moment
to establish the threshold. But don't those facts go to whether or not it became a de facto arrest? The case law on this issue, that is, when does an investigatory seizure become an arrest, says both. Would the person have thought they were in custody to a degree associated with arrest? But the case law also says that in making this determination, there's a fine line, and you have to balance sort of what are the reasons for the seizure and what are the concerns, if any, that justified the intrusive behavior of the police, the handcuffing, placing them in the squad, those sorts of things. So if that's the balance, then it seems to me, you know, the belligerent behavior, the clenched fist, we don't just say, well, did that give rise to probable cause? We have to say, well, did that provide a reasonable basis to use handcuffs and put him in the squad such that this was not an arrest?
I think I see your point. Although, again, it seems, if I'm understanding your question correctly, we are kind of, I think, melding this idea of was it in fact an arrest or was it in fact a justified arrest, which I would say you need probable cause for.
And let's not get to probable cause unless we first conclude that it was an arrest. Do you agree with that?
Correct. I do definitely agree with that. But I also agree
that his behavior leading up to the purported arrest is relevant in deciding whether or not it was actually an arrest.
I do agree that this court does take into account all of the circumstances, not just Mr. Smith's behavior, but also the officer's behavior.
Yes.
And you're right that it's correct that this court not only looks at, it's not just a simple mathematical equation of was there handcuffs, were you confined in a squad car, what does that equal? You do look at the intrusiveness and the aggressiveness of the police conduct and against what were the circumstances that might justify that behavior specifically.
And only if the police conduct was reasonable under those circumstances would we say this isn't an arrest. In other words, if the police conduct, the aggressive behavior, was unreasonably intrusive, we could conclude that this was a de facto arrest.
I agree.
Because those actions weren't warranted given the circumstances at hand.
I agree. I see your point, and I do agree with that. And so let's talk about that for a minute. So what we have is Mr. Smith, who is standing next to his vehicle in a driveway of a private residence, and he's minding his own business at the moment. Officer Spencer, in uniform and a marked squad car, parks at the end of the driveway. He commands Mr. Smith to approach him, to identify himself, and to explain what he's doing. Mr. Smith complied with the approaching the officer to talk to him and then questioned, what did I do wrong? Why are you asking me these questions? What's going on here? Which Officer Spencer determined to be a belligerent, not answering officer's questions.
Fist with the object, all right?
And there's the closed fist, for sure. But remember, what we have here is a complete absence in the record of any evidence that the officer in any way feared that fist contained some kind of contraband or anything dangerous that could harm the officer. If you look through this record, you will find no inkling of a suggestion that the officer feared for his safety in this case. Remember, when the officer also pried that fist open, what he saw was a key. So although I'm standing firm and emphasizing that the officer does not in any way articulate any concern that there's a weapon in that fist, it is absolutely dispelled once that fist is opened and we see that it's a car key. Now, on that point, one thing that I do want to reply to in terms of what the state raised in its brief, the state on page 6 of its brief suggests that the fact that Officer Spencer called for backup indicates that he feared for his safety. That's an incorrect fact. I'd like to point you back to the transcript at page 17, where when the officer is testifying, he explains that he had already called for backup. Those are his words. I already called for backup before he had any interaction with Mr. Smith whatsoever. So that calling for backup has nothing to do with a fear of officer safety.
In a case like this, I find it useful to look at the case law and see where the facts most closely align. Which case do you suggest most readily aligns with the facts here such that it should guide our analysis?
In terms of the de facto arrest, I would say Blackston, because what we have in that case is the handcuffing and the confining to the squad car.
For an hour and 15 minutes with no admitted intent to investigate anything.
This also was a detention for an hour in the back of the squad car.
That's what I was going to ask you. So I missed that in the record. So where do we get a time frame? Is that in the testimony? Is that what you're referring to?
It's in the evident from the videos, from the squad car videos.
But the squad video made part of the record in the stipulated fact proceeding?
Yes.
And how do you mark the hour, if you just give me that quickly? I mean, from when to when?
Are you asking for a time?
Like you from just 6 said, p.m. You made to 7 the comment p.m.? That this lasted 1 hour, and I just mean from what point to what point lasted 1 hour?
So this what I'm basing that on is when you start watching the squad video, Mr. Smith is just being brought into the squad. He's already handcuffed. He's just being put into the squad and placed in the back seat. Then what happens is the other officers arrive, and Mr. Smith is in the squad car for about an hour while the other officers are on scene.
At what point do they find the marijuana?
Yeah. Early.
So at that point, there's probably probable cause to arrest.
Mm-hmm.
So doesn't that sort of factor into how long he had a investigatory seizure as opposed to a probable cause arrest seizure? Because in Blackston, it was like the whole time this guy was in the car, there was no intent to investigate him for anything. Okay, well, your client was in the car perhaps for an hour, but early into that placement, they found marijuana and suspected that he was the source of the marijuana. So it seems like at that point, that's when we stopped the clock on the investigatory seizure.
I understand your point. And while, even if we accept then that he was not in the car for an hour pre-discovery of the marijuana, I don't think that fact in and of itself is dispositive because, like you said, as we look at case law, each case has a slightly different combination of facts. And if you look at Moffitt, which is also discussed in my brief, the court decided that confining to a squad car was not going to be a de facto arrest. But importantly there, that did not have the fact of the person being in handcuffs. Now, the state makes a big point about the fact that in Blackston, the defendant was ordered out of the car at gunpoint, and no such thing happened here.
That's a pretty big difference.
But I would again suggest to you that the vast majority of arrests are accomplished without the person being subjected to gunpoint. Remember, what the question here is in terms of a de facto arrest is whether the legal standard is whether a reasonable person would have, under the circumstances, concluded that they were under arrest and not free to go. So that's what we have to look at. That's our guiding principle here. So
the guiding principle, but the point I was trying to make earlier is, although the case says that, there's plenty of case law that also says you look at the totality of the circumstances and you consider the basis for the intrusion, weigh that against the aggressiveness of the police action and decide whether or not the police action was reasonable. I mean, that case or that balance kind of seems to trump what did the suspect think.
I agree with you that there is a balance, and I think the balance here clearly shows that Officer Spencer was incredibly aggressive and intrusive in his conduct in this stop, absolutely lacking any inkling of any fear of officer safety. From the moment Officer Spencer engaged with Mr. Smith, he was already suspicious that he was doing something wrong and trying to evade him just by virtue of standing next to this Land Rover in this driveway. Now, remember, what we also haven't talked about yet here is the fact, in terms of aggressive, intrusive behavior, the fact of physically grabbing onto Mr. Smith's hand and prying it open. So while we may not have a order you out at gunpoint, we certainly do have a uniformed officer showing a physical contact and a physical show of authority that he is going to make Mr. Smith submit to his will, and this is how it's going to happen. So I think all of the factors that we've talked about, balancing the aggressiveness of the officer conduct, utterly lacking any fear for officer safety, what he has done, show that the aggressive and intrusive methods here transformed what was maybe initially a detention into a de facto arrest. Now, I'm almost up on time, so just for now, I'd like to just point out to you that moving to the fruits analysis here, as I detailed in the brief, I think this is a standard fruits analysis following from the Davis case, and I just wanted to point out to the court that here the state does not dispute either that this was fruit or that there would be no probable cause for an arrest. So I think really the heart of the issue here is whether this situation did convert into a de facto arrest, and then we're left with the state making no argument about probable cause or fruits. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. As I said in my brief, this case is not close. Judge Kyle's order is thorough and correct. What I'd like to do this morning is go through the four steps that led to the discovery of the marijuana. Perhaps skipping the fourth step, because the appellant hasn't argued today, as in the brief, that looking in the bag was a warrantless search. So I'll address that if you have questions, but appellant has not made that argument today. So the first three steps are the seizure, the questioning, and then the handcuffing and putting in the squad car. The seizure, appellant has conceded, was valid based on the speeding. Now, I'm a little confused about appellant's argument because there also seems to be an argument that, well, that wasn't the purpose of the seizure, but it's an objective test, and objectively, speeding is a basis for a seizure. So the initial seizure, at least, is not even close. I mean, that's clearly valid. The main point appellant makes here seems to be that, well, the scope and duration of the seizure was illegally expanded by Officer Spencer. But Officer Spencer had seven things that altogether gave him reasonable, articulable suspicion to go beyond just the speeding here. First, as already discussed, there's the quick turn into the driveway, which the officer described as evasive. Second, there's approaching the house, but then not engaging in the house at all, just going back to sit in the car or in the SUV. Third, there's getting out of the passenger side of the SUV, even though you're sitting in the driver's seat, and then standing on the passenger side. Those things are all suspicious, and that's before...
suspicious of what?
Of a crime having been committed. Officer doesn't have to be able to put his finger on what he thought maybe the car was stolen, he said. Maybe he's casing the house. We don't know. But importantly...
Case law generally say evasive behavior gives rise to reasonable articulable suspicion, even if you don't know what the crime might be.
I think it does, Your Honor, and I think that is certainly a fair reading here that... The officer certainly read it that way, that the quick turn into the driveway and that apparently not having anything to do with the private property there. But I think the important thing in this case is you don't have to wrestle with any one or two or even three of these, whether they're enough for reasonable articulable suspicion, because aside from these three things, we also have, and I think this is very important, the minute that the officer decides to talk to appellant won't answer any questions and won't identify himself.
Is he required to?
Well, you can't give him a speeding ticket unless he's going to identify himself. So the idea that the scope and duration were expanded here is ridiculous because the officer couldn't let him go at that point. He couldn't just write him a ticket and say, don't speed anymore, be on your way, because the guy won't identify himself. So the idea that the duration should have been shorter here doesn't make any sense when appellant won't answer any questions or identify himself. That's point number four in the seven for reasonable articulable suspicion. Then again, we have the closed fist, which he refuses to open. That's number five. Number six is him, appellant denied he got out of the SUV, which is frankly just bizarre since the officer just seen him driving it. So that's certainly suspicious. And then appellant is belligerent and uncooperative. That's number seven. So when you take all seven of those things together, clearly you have reasonable articular suspicion. I mean, this court has described that test as, quote, not high, unquote. It's a minimal test. And the fact that appellant won't identify himself alone means there wasn't any expansion of the scope and duration of the seizure. Because, again, the officer can't just write him a ticket for speeding and let him go. This wasn't just a routine traffic stop for a broken taillight or something where the officer decides to go on a fishing expedition. Here, the officer had these seven things, and that provided him the minimal amount required for reasonable articulable suspicion. And that's why Judge Kyle correctly found that there wasn't any illegal expansion of the seizure here. And again, the seizure was clearly valid. Based on the speeding.
Which of the behaviors you've identified would you say establish are the basis for the officer having suspicion of evasive conduct, specifically evasion?
Well, there's the quick dart into the driveway. There's also the fact that it doesn't appear that he was going to visit his buddy or something like that, since he went up to the house but then didn't engage at all and just got back
but
in the car.
But isn't evasion of the officer?
Well,
so how is that evasion? That's what I'm trying to follow.
I think what it suggests is that the move in the driveway was evasive and wasn't just, oh, I've reached my destination, so I'm going to park. I just happened to have parked really quickly as soon as the officer got behind me. And then you have the getting out on the passenger side. Now, the officer didn't see him get on the passenger side, but he's watching the driver's side door, so the only other way out of the car.
Wasn't the only thing visible his feet and ankles? Is that right?
Right. He saw his feet and his ankles on the other side of the car.
So suggesting what he's hiding in some way?
Suggesting that he has gotten out of the car in a way the officer can't see him getting out of the car and hiding something, which, in fact, looks like is what happened here. He put the plastic bag outside the car on the ground. So those things go to the evasion. And again, the argument here really seems to be expansion.
But after that, it seems like the evasion does stop at some point because, in fact, Mr. Smith does come forward when the officer asks him to. You've already described the manner in which he came forward, but he did come forward. So that's not evasion, right?
No. I think the question then is there a point where the officer should have just said, oh, I'm just going to write you a ticket for speeding and let you go because I haven't seen any more evidence of any wrongdoing? But that point never arrived because appellant never identified himself. You can't write a John Doe ticket for speeding. So the fact that appellant wouldn't identify himself and did all these other suspicious things is what meets the very minimal test of reasonable articulable suspicion.
What justified the use of handcuffs and placing him in a squad video without converting this into a de facto arrest?
Well, that is, I think, the heart of the matter here. And I think the key fact here is that appellant was told he was being detained for investigation. Appellant commented today on how he was told he was being detained, but the full picture here is he was told you're being detained for investigation. And appellant has not cited any case where a court has said, well, even though a suspect was told that, the suspect wouldn't have believed it and would have thought he or she was really actually under arrest. And not free to leave alone is not good enough. We know that. It has to be not free to leave to the extent associated with formal arrest.
And where in the record do we know that the words for investigation were used?
The officer described that's what he did. And I believe it was in the...
What I'm asking is, will the record tell us that it wasn't just that the officer said you're being detained, the officer said you're being detained for investigation?
Right. Now, and I'm glad you asked that, because it's on page 17. I don't have the transcript in front of me, but according to my notes, it's on page 17. The officer said he handcuffed appellant. He did so because he wanted to continue to investigate, and he explained to appellant that he was being detained while the officer investigated. That's what my notes say is on page 17 of the transcript.
Thank you.
And I think that's also important here because one of the arguments, and I'm probably jumping ahead a little bit, is the officer had no fear for his safety, and he called for backup before any of this happened. I think pages 16 and 17 also rebut that. The officer said he handcuffed appellant. He did so because he wanted to continue to investigate. And he said, the officer said he had called for assistance because of appellant's resistance during the initial part of the investigation. So it isn't that the officer called for backup before he even talked to appellant. It's that he called for backup before he handcuffed appellant. And he says he did it because appellant was belligerent. So that definitely does suggest a concern for officer safety. The officer mentions the belligerents, and he called for backup. You don't call for backup if everything's hunky-dory. So the officer acted reasonably here, given appellant's actions and suspicious behavior. There's no case law that says handcuffs plus squad car equals arrest. As you've pointed out, the Blackston case is very different because Blackston turns on the fact that the officer had no intention of conducting any investigation while he detained Mr. Blackston. The Supreme Court noted that. Here, the officer expressly told appellant he was detaining him so he could investigate further. And then they very quickly found the marijuana. So it isn't like he was detained for an hour while the officers were doing I don't know what. The backup officer arrived, went over by the car, saw the marijuana, saw the bag, found the marijuana.
So roughly how long was Mr. Smith in the back of the squad car before the marijuana was found?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the squad video was actually part of this suppression hearing.
Oh, okay.
It's probably part of the record for the stipulated facts trial. But I don't think that was before Judge Kyle, and there was no...
In that, because Judge Kyle's order from the suppression hearing says he received, I think, four exhibits consisting of photographs. So it's not clear to me that the squad video is part of the record from the suppression hearing or, therefore, before this court.
I think that's true, and I think it's also important that no argument was ever made to Judge Kyle that the detention here was unreasonably long. I mean, if there was, then the officer could have explained exactly what happened step by step. But I think that argument's been forfeited because the argument below was just, you shouldn't have detained me at all, not you detained me for too long. So we've got a seizure here based on speeding. That's an objective test. We've got seven facts that give you reasonable article suspicion. We've got then the handcuffing and putting in the squad car. And again, appellant was told he was detained for an investigation. That's key fact number one. Key fact number two is, at that point, appellant knew the officer hadn't seen him do anything illegal except for the speeding. So why would a reasonable person think he's under arrest when the officer has no basis for arresting him? It's not like the officer had just seen him do something that would support an arrest.
The point being, though, being put in the back of a squad car, because nothing changed when they found the drug. In other words, his detention was physically very much the same. It's just at that point now there is probable cause, so it just becomes from a detention from the state's perspective or de facto arrest to a proper arrest as soon as the drug's found. But his level of objectively believing or subjectively believing he had no right to leave didn't change.
Well, again, the squad video isn't in the record, I don't think, before this court. But presumably when the police officers found the marijuana, they talked about it and an appellant was aware of it. And usually there would be some questioning. Do you know where this bag came from? Is this yours? I don't know what happened here because we don't have the squad video. But I think the point is, at the appellant's argument is that the minute he was handcuffed and put in the squad car, that was an arrest. There's no probable cause. I agree there's no probable cause, and I agree this is the fruit of the poisonous tree if there's a poisonous tree. The point is, there's no poisonous tree because there was reasonable articulable suspicion. The case law does not say squad plus cuffs equals arrest.
Actually, the case law says the opposite.
Right. And those cases don't involve someone who was expressly told you're being detained for investigation, where there's no reason for the person to think he's under arrest because at that point, all he's done is speeding as far as the officer knows or as far as he knows the officer knows. There's been a discussion today about whether the officer acted...
Clarify, though, that detention, this is an exceptional, in other words... to investigate, that's what a standard, even DWI stop, you have, you're detained, field sobriety and so forth, and now I place you under arrest when you've, and now handcuffs go on in the squad car. The point being, and the state believes there's sufficient evasive conduct, those seven factors that made this an exceptional detention, which takes what otherwise would be an arrest going into a squad car, a non-arrest, therefore no probable cause needed.
Right. Because of the officer's reasonable behavior, given that, I think it's important to remember here, this is a February night at 6 o'clock. So we know it's dark out. We know the officer's all by himself. We know he has concerns, otherwise he wouldn't have called for backup. We know appellant was being belligerent. We know appellant has a closed fist. And appellants argued, well, there wasn't anything in the fist. Well, a fist alone can be a weapon. It doesn't have to have something in it. You can punch somebody with a closed fist, whether or not you're holding a key or a blackjack or something else inside there. So, and he wouldn't open the fist except when the officer pried it open, essentially. Again, appellant won't identify himself, so the officer can't just write him a ticket and let him go. And the officer can't check and see if there's warrants for this guy's arrest or if there's other reasons that the officer should fear for his safety. So the officer reasonably acted out of caution here to investigate. And again, it didn't last long. Backup shows up. They find the marijuana. This court has talked in the past about not second-guessing officers' safety concerns and the reasonable steps they take. That's what we have here, given that he's alone.
And do we have testimony from the officer saying that he had safety concerns?
He doesn't use the magic word officer safety, no. But he talks about he called for backup because of appellant's belligerence. And I think the only logical conclusion for that is he wants some help here. If appellant had been calm, cool, and collected, there wouldn't be the belligerence, probably no call for backup because there's no need. But instead, we've got somebody who won't answer questions, denies getting out of the car he was just in, won't open his closed fist, et cetera. I won't belabor that point. So I think that just leaves the looking in the bag, which, again, appellant hasn't argued. I could discuss that in my brief. I don't plan to go into that today unless this court has questions on it.
Well, my question is only whether that was part of the district court's ruling such that it would be properly before this court in a proceeding in which there was a stipulation of the state's case to obtain review of the pretrial ruling, in which case our review is supposed to be limited to the pretrial ruling. And the district court's order says the issues raised and determined were legality of the stop and seizure of defendant and search of defendant and the car, nothing about search of the bag.
Right. And that's the argument I make in my brief. There was no argument below that the cops should have got a warrant before looking in the bag. So that argument has been waived. Now, it could have still been raised on appeal under a plain error analysis, but there was no plain error argument here, so that's also been forfeited.
How can it be raised under plain error if we have a rule that says if you use this process, 2601, subdivision 4, whatever it is, to obtain review of a pretrial ruling, everybody has to agree
right.
The appeal will only be of the pretrial ruling and nothing else. Despite that clear rule where everybody has to agree what the parameters of appeal are, we're going to look at something else.
Right. And perhaps I should say, at best, it can be raised under plain error. But I think you make a good point that when the arguments for the judge are limited, that's all that's before the court on appeal. It's not like there's a trial where you might have evidence that comes in and there could be a plain error question. This is different because it's a suppression hearing on a very limited issue or set of issues. And my time is up. So I will simply ask that you affirm Judge Kyle. Thank you.
Your Honors, the first point I'd like to make, excuse me, on rebuttal is going back to this issue of officer safety. I've reread pages 16 to 17 of the transcript over and over and over again, and I simply do not read it the way the state reads it. Starting at the bottom of page 16, the officer is explaining, the question is, okay, so at this point, did you secure him, meaning Mr. Smith, in handcuffs? The answer is yes. Question, why did you do that? Answer, I wanted to continue to investigate, and I explained to the defendant at this time he was being detained while I investigated. The amount of resistance I was being met with during the initial part of the investigation, I had already called for an additional squad for assistance, and I believe that I had two-person squads that were coming to the area. The way I read that is he's explaining to Mr. Smith, you're being detained because I'm going to investigate. I already called squads for backup. That's how I read this. In terms of for fear of officer safety, the call was made before he encountered Mr. Smith and had any kind of engagement with, I should say before he had any engagement with him. Now, on this idea of was this a de facto arrest supported by probable cause, it was interesting to me listening to Mr. Raggetts' argument. It seems like we essentially agree what all the facts were that led up to the moment of the handcuffing and the detention in the squad. And the state takes you as far as to say that's reasonable articulable suspicion, conceding it's not probable cause. So we really have to figure out here, was this a de facto arrest or not? And I am going to point you back again to what our legal standard is in terms of whether a reasonable person would have concluded under the circumstances he was under arrest and not free to go. Remember, what we have here is the officer merely being suspicious. He says again and again and again in his testimony he was suspicious, but he never articulates suspicious about what. He's suspicious about Mr. Smith, but has no facts to justify the suspicion that Mr. Smith, quote, possibly did not live in the area. The officer talks about being suspicious that he was that Mr. Smith was trying to evade him by pulling into this residence, but acknowledges he has no information about the residence or whether
Counsel,
or not Mr. Smith lives there.
I'm going to ask the reasonable person question, I think at least. I hear what you're saying, but as I read this case, I think to myself, if Mr. Smith had simply pulled out his driver's license and said, oh, sorry, was I speeding? We would have had a ticket. We would have been done. It seems to me that this escalated because Mr. Smith was apparently frustrated with the circumstances, became belligerent, is what the district court found, had a clenched fist and wouldn't answer questions that were reasonably related to a traffic stop. So, I mean, I feel like we can't ignore his behavior in considering whether the officer was justified in thinking, okay, I have some suspicions because he was speeding, then he was evasive, I want to figure out what's going on, and based on how he's behaving, I'm going to cuff him and put him in the squad until I sort this out. That's what this seems like. And the Supreme Court has said several times, you know, temporarily handcuffing a suspect and putting him in the squad while investigating the circumstances leading to the seizure does not result in an arrest. I'm having a hard time seeing how under the totality of the circumstances, including Mr. Smith's behavior, this converted to an arrest simply because we had handcuffs and placement in a squad car.
It's not simply because there were handcuffs and placement in a squad car. Let me be abundantly clear about that. I think those are critical facts, but it's not the only facts. And let's be clear, too, about what this record is not. This is not an officer whose first question to Mr. Smith is, hey, can I see your license and registration? The officer testifies that his first question to Mr. Smith is, why are you getting out of the passenger side of that car? Okay, this is not a seizure based on a speeding that we're going to investigate, and then the
but
investigation
isn't it a
doesn't happen.
Based on speeding plus evasive conduct.
Your Honor, as Davis points out, evasive conduct, that a person acts in a way that demonstrates he does not want to engage with police, does not amount to reasonable articulable suspicion of criminal activity.
Mr. Davis wasn't the driver of the automobile that engaged in a traffic violation. He was a passenger. Here we have the driver of the vehicle commit a traffic violation and then engage in evasive conduct. Doesn't that distinguish this from Davis?
Absolutely not, because the point is that if the officer wanted to investigate for the traffic infraction, go ahead. That's not what he did.
Why
he did something else altogether.
Why can't he investigate for the evasive conduct as well? We have case law that says evasive conduct alone is a basis for an investigatory seizure. So in those cases, there wasn't even a traffic violation. Just that, making eye contact with the police and making a sharp turn off the road in a way that reasonably suggests to the officer that the driver is trying to avoid the police. And the appellate courts have said that's a basis for a stop in and of itself. Don't we have that here?
If the officer is going to investigate, okay, let's be clear again about how these steps happen. This court, if this court is going to say that the seizure was based on the speeding, then the investigation has to...
I'm not. I'm looking at this thinking the seizure is based on speeding plus evasive conduct.
Okay. Then if you're looking at it in terms of evasive conduct, you have to, again, following Davis, talk about what does it mean to be evasive? And here what it means is the officer thinks that this person doesn't want to interact with him.
Okay.
That's what we had in Davis. And Davis said not wanting to interact with an officer is not reasonable articulable suspicion of criminal activity.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank
Any
you.
Other questions? Thank you for your arguments. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision in the 90 days required by statute.